I'm thinking about what I have to grade. What? Fernando, your company's never made it to the summary. Your company's never made it. No, I included your company. I said your company's never made it into the summary, but they did. So. Hi, how are you? How much extra time do you need to get it done?
Sorry?
How much extra time do you need to get it done? No, but how much time is the group? Do you think the group will take to get done?
I hope they'll get done. But
if they don't get done by tonight, yeah, send me yours. But wait, give them a few hours to do them. Okay, folks. Can you hear me? No? To me after class, we'll figure something out.
Okay. And
he's not here.
Just to submit him.
Yeah.
I'll talk to you.
Okay. Can you hear me? No. Okay, now it's working. Okay, never mind. It's working now. Yeah. Thank you. Okay, folks, the end is here. Every semester that I teach this class, I wonder whether it all will work out at the end. It always seems to. I keep my fingers crossed. But it always seems to work out at the end in the sense of, you know, the projects all come in, the valuations get done. So today we're actually going to use, I mean, this class I'm going to use partly as a review session for the entire class and partly so you can see what you found in your own projects. Before I show you your numbers, though, you know how they have disclaimers in emails? All the investment banking emails, half the email is a disclaimer. I'm going to add a disclaimer. The numbers you're going to see are your numbers. If you see a screwy number there, it's not my fault. I didn't mess with any of your numbers. I did fix a couple, like one company, the value was 300,000, sort of, and the stock was trading at 30, and the email came in at 5:44 in the morning. Which either means that you went to sleep really early last night, woke up this morning and started working, which is very unlikely. Or you've been working through the night, at which point you are completely delirious, and I just added a couple of decimal points for you. Okay? So let's see whether we can use what you've done in the project as a kind of a review for the entire class. So if you remember the very first classes, there were three ways you could put a number on an asset. The first is intrinsic valuation. In intrinsic valuation, you estimate and guess, whatever the right word is, cash flows, discount rates, and growth rates, and you bring it all together in a DCF to value the asset. In relative valuation, you price the asset by looking at what similar assets are being priced out there. And in some very exceptional cases, you draw on option pricing models to value an asset whose cash flows are contingent on something happening. That's it. Every valuation approach out there is in one of those three buckets. So I'm going to spend about 40 minutes doing a review of intrinsic valuation. Kind of, and I'm going to do it in the form of a quiz where actually, I know it's going to be a quiz where we, at each stage, I'm going to stop and ask you, what should I do? And I think you have all the ammunition you need to be able to answer these questions. But to structure this review, I'm going to draw on Dante's Inferno. Ever read Dante's Inferno? Dante was this, I think, really disturbed Italian guy. Who wrote an entire book about layers of hell. I remember I was asked to read it in college, but I read the Cliff Notes version. It was too boring. Actually, it was a combination of boring and was actually upsetting me to see so many layers of hell. So I'm going to use Dante's Inferno to kind of illustrate some of the issues in valuation. Because if you think about it, intrinsic valuation should be simple, right? There are four ingredients that go into it. The first are the cash flows you get from your existing assets. The second is the value of growth. The value of growth shows up in two places, as a growth rate and as a reinvestment to sustain that growth. The third is in the risk that you show in the discount rate. And finally, you put closure by assuming that at some point in time, your company will be a mature company and you bring it back to the present. Everything we do in DCF is around those four ingredients. So here's my version of Dante's Inferno. So here's what we're going to do. I'm going to start off with tests. In each test, if you fail, you're going to be in a layer of hell. So we're going to start with the kind of mild failures where it's just a little warm. And as we go down, we're going to kind of up the ante. And if you fail those layers, you're going to get into harder and harder layers of hell. So we're going to go through nine layers of hell. And here are the nine layers. I'm going to start off with what I call the base year fixation. You know what that is? We act like the whole world began in 2016. You have the 2016 numbers. You forget that the company was around 2015, 2014, 2013. It's all gone. So I'm going to talk about how that's going to get us into trouble. Next, I'm going to talk about taxes, how we mess up on taxes and our cash flows and our discount rates. Third, I want to talk about high growth, because we're so casual about throwing in 20% growth for the next 10 years, the next 15 years. I want to talk about how long does high growth last. Fourth, we're going to do a very quick review of what should be in your discount rate and what should not be in your discount rate. Fifth, whenever we talk about growth, the question that always should follow what your growth rate is how much are you reinvesting for that growth? So I'm going to ask, are you paying for growth? Then I want to talk about debt ratios and the cost of capital and how they can and should change for some companies as you go through time. And as they change, the cost of capital will change. Then we're going to do a very quick review of that big number in every DCF, the terminal value, the kinds of mistakes we can make in the terminal value. And after we're done with the valuation, we're going to talk about the kinds of premiums and discounts we often add to the valuation to get to a final value, and how we get from aggregate value to value per share. And there's going to be one final layer of hell that I'm going to call the Wasserstein-Perella layer of hell. And if you fail that test, this class, you might as well wipe this class entirely out of your memory. It's almost like the class never happened. So ready? Let's go for a tour of hell. Let's start with the base year fixation. So here's what I did. I took ExxonMobil, and this was in 2009. In fact, ExxonMobil in 2009 bears a lot of resemblances to ExxonMobil in 2017. You're going to see in a moment why. So in 2009, I wanted to value ExxonMobil. I went and got the numbers from 2008. And here's what the numbers look like. $477 billion in revenues, $58 billion in after-tax operating income, $4 billion in net CapEx and change in working capital, free cash flow to the firm of $54 billion. So assume that I've got the cash flow right, that I haven't screwed up getting the cash flow for 2008. I'm going to assume an 8% cost of capital, which is not an unreasonable cost of capital. The company is mature, ExxonMobil, probably a little high if you ask me, and a stable growth rate of 2%, just above the inflation rate. So I've got a cash flow for the most recent year, $54 billion. I've got an 8% cost of capital and a 2% growth rate forever. I give you those numbers and say, what's the value of ExxonMobil? Assuming it's a mature company, what's the value going to be? You take the free cash flow, you grow it at 2%, divide by 8 minus 2%. That should be about $900 billion plus, right? $900 billion. Just take the cash flow. There are only three ingredients: cash flow, cost of capital, and growth rate. The actual market cap for the company was $373 billion. Something is either totally off in my valuation, or this is the most undervalued stock ever. Here's my question. What am I missing? Clearly, there's something that's wrong with my valuation. The company can't be worth $900 billion. But I used only three numbers: free cash flow to the firm from the most recent year, cost of capital, and growth rate. So if I'm screwing up, it must be in one of those three numbers. Which of those three numbers is most suspect? Are you okay with the 2% growth rate forever? You can make it zero if you want. I'd still get $750 billion. The 8% cost of capital is actually 1% above the median cost of capital. So it's not the growth rate, it's not the cost of capital. So what that leaves us with the cash flow, right? I'm just using last year's free cash flow. It's a mature company. Why would the cash flow change so much for a mature company? It's a mature oil company, though, right? And why does that matter? Oil prices had dropped 30% between 2008 and 2009. I was using 2000. There's nothing wrong with the 2008 numbers, but they reflect what oil prices used to be. In 2009, oil prices are down 30%. I can't just take the most recent year and put a growth rate and a cost of capital. I'm going to inflate the value. So what's the solution? What should I be doing? I should be adjusting the operating income and the revenues for the new oil prices. I should be normalizing the numbers, because as long as I stay with last year's numbers, this is always going to happen. So when you do your valuation, I know it's natural to pull up the last 10K, the last annual report, and start going with it. But remember, it's only 1 year, and there were other years before it. Don't ignore the information in time. Let's move forward. Let's talk about taxes and value. Let's assume I gave you the following numbers for a company. EBITDA, $140 million, minus depreciation amortization of $40 million, gives me EBIT. I subtract out interest expense. I give you taxable income, interest expense, EBIT minus interest expense. I have taxes, net income. So basically, I've given you the income statement for the company. I want you to compute the free cash flow to this, for this company, assuming it is a mature company with zero growth. That's going to be relevant in your calculation. It's a mature company with constant cash flows, a zero growth rate forever. Estimate the free cash flow to the firm for the company. And in case you've forgotten the free cash flow to the firm definition, which you shouldn't, but I'll put it on the side. EBIT times 1 minus the tax rate, minus net capex, minus change in working capital is free cash flow to the firm. Let's start with the part that is a little puzzling. I haven't given you net capex, right? I haven't given you the capex. I haven't given you the working capital. But I'm going to argue you don't need to know those for this company. Why is that? It has no growth. And because it has no growth, complete the story. Anna, what? You don't need to reinvest. If you don't need to reinvest, net capex goes to zero. Change in working capital goes to zero. So you can stretch this out. So all I have to do is estimate EBIT times 1 minus T, net of taxes, and I should be home free, right? So what's my after-tax operating income for this company? And I'll give you the choices. I can take $48 million and add back the depreciation. That's $88 million. I can take EBIT minus taxes plus depreciation. So basically, you see the choices there. The question is, which of those numbers is my free cash flow to the firm if the company is a stable growth company? What's my EBIT? Let's figure the easy number out. My EBIT is $100 million, right? So the real question is, what taxes should I be taking out of that EBIT to come up with my free cash flow to the firm? Let me play devil's advocate. Can I subtract out the $32 million and come up with free cash flow to the firm of $68 million. Look, the taxes are right there. Why shouldn't I? Why shouldn't I be subtracting out the $32 million to get to free cash flow? Fernando? What should I be subtracting out as taxes? Ari, help me out. What should I be subtracting out as taxes? What other stuff? I'll help you out. I have interest expenses there, right? My interest expenses are lowering my taxable income. It's lowering taxes. Okay, let's start with the 40% tax rate. Everybody agree the tax rate is 40%, 32 divided by 80 million, right? I have a 40% tax rate. When I do free cash flow to the firm, it's a pre-debt cash flow. I have to act like I have no interest expenses. Remember why? Why should I act like there are no interest expenses? Because the tax benefits from interest expenses show up where? In my discount rate, in the cost of debt and cost of capital. So when I do my cash flows, I have to act like there are no tax benefits from interest expenses, which means I have to act like I get taxed on the entire $100 million. And if I were paying a 40% tax rate on $100 million, I'd be paying $40 million out of the $100 million. My after-tax operating income should be $60 million, which will now become my free cash flow to the firm because the company has no growth. So whenever we multiply EBIT by the 1 minus the tax rate, remember, we're acting like we have no interest expenses. And if we have no interest expenses, that would be our cash flow. We discount those at the cost of capital, which captures the tax benefits from interest expenses. We're home free. So the right answer there is $60 million. It's EBIT times 1 minus the 40% tax rate, and we have to act like the entire EBIT gets taxed. Any questions on that? Okay. Let's do a quick review of high growth. Whenever you sit down to value a company and you project out growth for the next 5 years, the next 10 years, it's easy on a spreadsheet to keep extending that growth period. So when you think about a high growth firm, a young high growth firm, lots of potential, lots of buzz about it, and you want to think about how long a typical young high growth firm should last, remember this graph that I showed you a long, long time ago when we were talking about terminal value? This actually looks at IPOs and the revenue growth at companies that have just gone public compared to the revenue growth of the sector they're in. So the way to read this graph is 1 year after the IPO, the revenue growth of these companies is 15% higher than the rest of the sector. They're high growth companies. 2 years later, that's down to 7% higher than the sector. 3 years later, it's down to 3% higher than the sector. By the time you get to year five, the company looks a lot like the sector. Growth fades incredibly fast at most companies. So you see these young high growth companies going public, lots of buzz, you buy into it because it's a high growth company. Be careful because in most companies, growth doesn't last very long. So now I'm going to play a game. I'm going to play the role of an equity research analyst who's going to screw up at every single turn in computing cost of capital. And as I screw up, I want you to keep tabs on everything I'm screwing up on. Okay? So my job is to assess the cost of capital for a tech firm. It's a tech firm that gets 20% of its revenues in Brazil, 80% in the U.S., so I'm going to go through step by step what I did. And at each step, don't jump in yet. At each step, keep tabs on what you would have done differently. So my job is to assess a cost of capital in US dollar terms for this company. So I started with the risk-free rate. I took a look at the current T-bond rate. It was only 3%. I felt it was too low. Why? Because I know historically rates have been much higher. So I replaced the 3% with a normalized rate, an average T-bond rate over the last 25 years. So I start with the risk-free rate of 5% rather than 3%. Remember your job. If this is not what you'd have done, just keep a tab on it. Right? Then I wanted a beta, so I did betas the way I was always taught. I went to the Bloomberg terminal. I looked up the beta for the company, a regression beta, and I used that as my beta. It's 1.20. I needed a risk premium, and the only way I was taught to get risk premiums was to look at the historical data. So I looked at this IBITS and historical database. And between 1926 and 2008, they told me that the risk premium for stocks over bonds was 5%. So I used that historical risk premium. So I've used a normalized risk-free rate, a regression beta, a historical risk premium. But I'm not quite done. This is a small company, and I've been always taught that I should be adding a small cap premium. That small company should have higher cost of equity. So I added a 3% small cap premium, again, based on that same historical data. By the time I was all done, my cost of equity was 14%. So normalized risk-free rate, regression beta, historical equity risk premium, and a small cap premium, 14% cost of equity. I put that cost of equity into my cost of capital calculation. I remembered from my finance classes that I should be using market value weights. And for equity, that was easy. I looked up the market cap. Debt, though, was not traded, and I waved my hands, and after a while I said, it's not traded. I should just take the debt off the books. And because I wanted to be conservative, I counted all debt, including accounts payable, supplier credit, everything I could find in the balance sheet, because that's what accounting is supposed to be, conservative. I ended up with $1 billion as total debt, including those liabilities. So that gave me a 50-50 weight for debt and equity. And then I wanted a cost of debt, and because normally you'd look up bonds and yield to maturity, but remember, this is all bank debt. I had nothing to do. So I took the interest expense for the company and divided by the book value of the debt. That's called a book interest rate. And I used the book interest rate of 3% as my pre-tax cost of debt. And to put a bow on this whole price, I multiplied that 3% that I got as my book interest rate by 1 minus the tax rate. And because the only tax rate I could find in the financial statements was an effective tax rate, I used a 30% effective tax rate. I have made at least 7 screw-ups in one cost of capital calculation. I wanted to start going down the list of every single mistake. Let's start with the first mistake. Fernando, what's the first thing you noticed? I should never normalize the risk-free rate. I'm going to put you on the spot, because this summer in your job, you're going to say that, and somebody's going to say, why not? I mean, we normalize everything else. We normalize margins. We normalize returns on capital. Why shouldn't I normalize risk-free rates?
Because it takes into account what historical stuff in the market is.
Why can't I use the same reasoning with ExxonMobil? Why should I be normalizing earnings there? That's historical too, right? Oil prices used to be high in the past. They're low now. You know, why am I allowed to normalize some stuff but not risk-free rates? I'll give you a helping hand. Let's suppose that you find the stock to be overvalued. What does the DCF tell you? Don't buy the stock. Put your money instead in what? In the risk-free investment, right? Now do you see why you don't want to normalize risk-free rates? If I decide not to buy the stock, I'm not going to be able to find a T-bond that delivers 5%. This is not something you normalize. This is an actual opportunity cost. And the way I've described it, and used this phrase multiple times before, you've got to live in the world you're in, not the world you wished you were in. And the fact that you might like rates to be higher is neither here nor there. So you should never normalize risk-free rates, because that is an actual opportunity cost. Mistake number one. Let's keep going. Anna, what's the second problem? I used a regression beta. So play devil's advocate. Again, I want you to get ready with your arguments, because 90% of all valuations done on Wall Street use regression betas. They use a Bloomberg beta. So tell me what's wrong with using a regression beta. No. Okay, let's suppose I gave you the index. I said it's against the S&P 500 like everybody else. No, that's not enough. So tell me why a bottom-up beta. I mean, I've kind of sold that religion, but now you're on the spot now. Somebody from Harvard Business School or Wharton is there across the table. They say, we were taught to use regression betas for computing cost of equity. Sam, give me an argument. What's wrong with regression betas? Yeah, so there are choices. The first is regression betas can be biased, depending on how. So you give me a Bloomberg terminal, you give me enough time, we can make the beta whatever we want it to be. That's the first problem. What's the second one? Anna? It's a statistical problem, right? You run a regression, you get a slope. The slope is not a fact. It's an estimate. It comes with a standard error, so it's noisy. So it's biased, it's noisy. Let's seal the coffin shut. The third problem is it is by definition backward-looking, right? So if your company has changed, its business mix has changed, its financial leverage has changed, a regression beta is not going to help you. So a regression beta looks like a fact until you start digging and you recognize how weak it is. Valiant's regression beta right now is 0. Take that to the next logical step. Do you think Valiant is a risk-free investment? It's not. A regression beta is completely useless when you've had strange things happen to your company. So that's the second problem, regression beta. Let's keep going. How did he get his risk premium? Luis, what did he do? Yeah. He used a historical risk premium, right? What's wrong with using historical risk premiums? What are we assuming will happen over time? In other words, we assume mean reversion. Things will reverse. You're saying, what's wrong with that? So we're going to reverse back to the 20th century. Is that what you're saying? That's basically what we implicitly assume when we use a historical risk premium. And the 20th century for the U.S. was a century where the global economy, 50% was from the U.S. You're not going to go back. So the first problem with historical risk premiums is you're assuming mean reversion to a mean. That's not going to be there. The second is the same problem Anna made about regression betas. When I give you a historical risk premium, I forgot to mention the standard error in that number, right? You might not remember, but even if you go all the way back to the 1920s, the standard error in that number is about 2%. So that 5% premium comes with a huge range around it. So it's mean reversion is dangerous, and it's a... So what's the alternative to using a backward-looking premium? User? The opposite, forward-looking premium. There you go, right? And how do we get a forward-looking premium? We estimate an implied premium by looking at where the S&P 500 is today. That way, we're not saddled to the past. We're saying, this is what people are demanding. So that was my push towards implied premiums, and the number can be very different. So third mistake is you should not have used a historical premium. It should have been an implied premium. You did add a small cap premium to that number. How many, you saw me do at least 30 valuations in this class, right? Full valuations. And how many of those did you see a small cap premium? None. I've never used a small cap premium in 32 years of valuation. And it's amazing how much it's become part of established practice. You value a small company, you're supposed to add a small cap premium. Why? Because that's what everybody does. Just because everybody does it doesn't mean it makes sense. The basis for the small cap premium is the same historical data from which you get that historical equity risk premium. It's even more noisy than the historical risk premium. And since 1981, it's not that. There is no small cap premium. Small cap stocks collectively have earned 0.18% less than large cap stocks. So we're building a premium for something that doesn't exist. So no small cap premiums. Small company, you believe it has higher fixed costs, give it a higher beta. Don't add a small cap premium. So the cost of equity, there are four problems. Let's keep going down to the cost of capital. How did the guy get a cost of debt? He took the book interest expense divided by book value of debt, came up with a 3% rate. There's already a contradiction in this cost of capital calculation that you can point out to the analyst. What's the contradiction? What's his risk-free rate that he said he was going to use? Wrong or not, he used a 5% risk-free rate, right? What's he saying his pre-tax cost of debt for this company is? A 3%. If you really mean it and your risk-free rate is 5%, how the heck can a company go out and borrow at 2% less than the risk-free rate? So I don't even have to contest the number. It doesn't make sense. And besides, book interest rates are a terrible way to estimate the cost of debt because they reflect whether you take short-term debt or long-term debt. When you borrow the money, they're not a reflection of the rate at which you can borrow money long-term today. So what should I be doing for my cost of debt? I should be starting with my risk-free rate, the right risk-free rate, and on top of that, I should be adding a default spread. And of course, this analyst says, how can you come up with a default spread if the company doesn't have bonds outstanding and a rating? What's the answer to that? We could use an interest coverage ratio, a synthetic rating, to come up with a default spread. That's going to give us a cost of debt. That's an estimate, but a far better estimate than using a book interest rate. So for the cost of debt, I should have used a default spread, either from an actual rating or a synthetic rating. What about this tax rate thing? You used an effective tax rate. Barbara, what should you have used for the cost of debt instead of the effective tax rate? The marginal tax rate. So I'm going to put you on the spot. The marginal tax rate in the U.S. is 40%. The effective tax rate for this company is 30%. Why should I use the marginal tax rate for the cost of debt? Well, it is a U.S. company, but I'm allowed to use effective tax rates in some places, but not in the cost of debt. So there must be something about debt. Keep going. You borrow money, you get interest expense. How does that work? How does it save you taxes? You subtract the interest expense from your taxable income. So if you have $1 million in income and $100,000 in interest expense, what do you report as taxable income? You take the million, you subtract the other 100, you report 900,000. You say, so what? Think of where you saved on taxes. You saved on the last $100,000 of your income, not the middle, not the first. The marginal tax rate is the tax rate that reflects the savings you get on the last dollars of your income. And that's why you don't use the effective tax rate. Apple's effective tax rate is a 22 or 23, maybe 25%. But when I compute Apple's cost of debt, I am going to use a 40% tax rate because that's exactly what Apple does with its borrowing, is it claims the tax benefits against its highest taxed income, not its lowest tax income. All of Apple's debt is in the U.S. getting that 40% tax benefit. So the cost of debt should have been based on what you can borrow at with a default spread. I should have used a marginal tax rate. Let's finish the process. The weights that he used were market value for equity. That's okay, billion. And then he took all liabilities, and his argument was, I'm just trying to be conservative. That's why I'm counting accounts payable and supplier credit. What's wrong with that argument? Okay, so, but Kerry, I'm just being conservative. I think that even that statement doesn't make sense. Am I being conservative counting everything as debt? What's happening? My debt ratio is going up, and when my debt ratio goes up, what happens to my cost of capital? It actually goes down. This is not conservative to push down your cost of capital. Can there be 7 mistakes in a cost of capital? Next time you see a cost of capital calculation, start taking it apart. There might not be 7, but there'll be 4, 5, 6. It's amazing how many mistakes you can make in one calculation. So if I did this right, here's what my numbers would look like. Instead of the T-bond rate, I would have, instead of the normalized T-bond rate, I'd have used the actual T-bond rate. Instead of the Bloomberg beta, I'd have used the bottom-up beta. For the equity risk premium, not only would I have used an implied premium, but there was something else I forgot. It gets 20% of its revenues in Brazil, so when I compute my equity risk premium, I have to bring in either a lambda and the adjustment or adjust my equity risk premium for my exposure to Brazil. For my cost of equity, therefore, instead of a 14% cost of equity, I end up with a 15.68% cost of equity. So I'm not adding a small cap premium, but I end up with a higher cost of equity because I have a higher equity risk premium because of the Brazil exposure and I have a bottom-up beta. My cost of debt is 9%, not 3%. That's a big difference because I'm adding the default spread of 6% based on the synthetic rating, much higher cost of debt. My overall cost of capital for the company, if I use the right mix of equity and debt, just the interest-bearing debt, would be 12.6%, not 8.05%. Think of how much of a difference your value will have if you use a 12.6% discount rate rather than an 8% discount rate. So take a look at this example because it kind of hits all those different sessions. Each of these was a session, right? We spent a session on risk-free rates, a session on betas, a session on equity risk premiums. I was trying to compress it all into one example. Any questions about discount rates, Sam?
As a combination between this layer and layer 2, when you talk about the taxes, why is this why would we include the tax, after-tax cost of debt in the
discount rate rather than the cash flows?
We could just make
that's actually a good question. Sam's question was, why not include the tax savings from interest in the cash flows? And if I do that, what should my discount rate, what should my cost of capital be? It should be a weighted average of my cost of equity and the
cost of capital.
I should use a pre-tax cost of debt rather than an after-tax cost of debt. So that's perfectly okay. The only thing is if your debt ratio changes over time, it's easier to change your cost of capital than it is to change your cash flows. It's purely pragmatic. Okay, so if you wanted to include the interest tax savings in your cash flows and use a pre-tax cost of debt in your cost of capital, you'll end up with a higher discount rate and higher cash flows. And if you do it right, you'll end up with the same value. But if your debt ratio changes over time, doing it through the cash flows is a pain in the neck because you actually have to project out dollar interest expenses. Imagine doing that in your DCF going out 10 years. If you have a company that's going from small to large, you'll have to estimate how much debt you will have, what the interest expense will be each year, and doing this each year. It's much more difficult to do that through your cash flow than it is through the discount rates. It's purely pragmatic.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'll tell you why it does make sense. Remember, one of the things we ask is, what's the right debt ratio for a company? One of the nice things about keeping the debt out of the cash flow is you can now change the cost of capital mix and see how that affects your value. Whereas once you build it into your cash flows, let's suppose in the corporate finance section, when I ask you what's your optimal debt ratio, if you build into the cash flows, it's much more difficult to do things like, what will happen if my debt ratio goes from 20% to 50%? So from that perspective, from a pragmatic perspective, I think it makes sense to leave the debt cash flows out of your cash flows and bring it into your discount rate. The adjusted present value approach, if you remember in corporate finance, does confront the debt directly, where I try to compute the value created or destroyed by debt by looking at the interest expense and the tax benefits from the debt. Okay. Let's talk about growth. I'm going to show you a company where I'm going to be the management team, and I'm going to supply you with cash flows. And I want you to ask me some questions about these cash flows. I want you to ask me good questions that will tell you whether I've thought through my cash flow. So I'm the management team. I supply you with revenues for the next 4 years. I tell you there's 10% growth in revenues. I give you after-tax operating depreciation, CapEx. So I've given you the entire free cash flow to the firm table. So it's your turn. Ask me some questions about these cash flows to see if I've thought through what I need to do. First, let's start with the revenue growth rate. What kind of question will you ask me to see if the revenue growth, because left to my own devices as a management, what am I going to do? I'm going to keep pumping up the revenue growth rate because it makes me look better, right? So what's the first question you're going to ask me about revenue growth? In fact, you can tell me what the reinvestment rate is. I've told you what the reinvestment rate is, and how would you compute it? What's the definition of reinvestment rate? This is quiz three throwback for those of you who have bad memories of it. What's the definition of reinvestment rate? It's CapEx minus depreciation plus change in working capital. So if you take CapEx minus, so that's 6 million in divided by 30 is 20%. So ask me the next question. The reinvestment rate I've given you is 20%. The growth rate I'm assuming is 10%. In fact, if you want to really put me on the spot, get me in the right place before you slam me. So the first question you got to ask me is, what kind of return on capital did you make last year? So I'm not even realizing what I'm wandering into. I tell you, I made a 12% return on capital last year. I'm very proud about it. Now ask me the next question. What's the return on capital I'm assuming in my cash flows? If my growth rate is 10%, my reinvestment rate is 20%, my return on capital is 50%, right? You see how I've kind of wandered into a place where if my return on capital was 12% last year, the question you're going to ask me is, what's changed in this company that you magically are going to make a 50% return on capital? And my response is, what are you talking about? Because I didn't even think about the return on capital. I just assumed CapEx and depreciation, working capital. So the key question you're going to ask me here is, and if I told you my historical return on capital is 50%, then maybe you can start to ask questions about competitive advantages and barriers to entry. But if my return on capital is 12%, I'm assuming a 50% return on capital. The question you're going to ask is, what's different about the company? What's changed? How can your return on capital jump so much? And if I don't have a good answer, these cash flows are null and void. There's no point even doing evaluation around them because they mean nothing. The other question to look at is, as my revenues are growing, remember, if I am a mature company in a mature sector, let's say I'm the largest company in my sector. My market is 200 million, I have a 50% market share, and I'm putting in a 10% growth rate every year. I'm going to say, stop. You already have a 50% market share. If the market's not growing, how can your revenues grow 10% a year without you cutting prices? And you say, well, I plan to cut prices. Well, then how come your margins are not dropping and your returns on capital are not dropping? Let me wander into that spot before you kind of, because in a sense, if you let me give you the numbers, you can very quickly confront me with my own contradictions. So you will face, especially if you're working valuation, you'll face a lot of people giving you forecasts for the future. And you'll say, I'm the low person in the totem pole. What the hell am I going to do? I just have to discount them. You might have to do it anyway, but ask some questions about those cash flows to make sure they're internally consistent. Let's talk about debt ratios. The cost of capital, you need a debt ratio. So let's assume I give you a company, in this case, Hormel Foods. Right now, it's 90% equity, 10% debt, and its cost of equity is 7.31%. The cost of debt after taxes, so I end up with a cost of capital of 6.8%. Okay? So let's assume the calculation's been done right. That's our existing cost of capital. Then I tell you the target debt ratio for this company is 30%. Don't ask me how I came up with the target. I just made it up. And I ask you, what will the cost of capital for Hormel Foods be at 30% debt? This seems like a slam dunk, right? Can I just go and change the weights there to 0.7 and 0.3 and recompute the cost of capital? Why not? Why not, Rachel?
Because it's going to be more risky if you take on more debt.
So take me through the process of what I'll need to do. No, I'll help you along. For the cost of equity, what's a key number that drives the cost of equity?
Beta.
And what's a beta function of? Your unlevered beta and your debt-to-equity ratio. So basically, if I go from a 10% debt to 30% debt, I have to unlever the beta and re-lever it. I'll end up with a higher beta and a higher cost of equity. What about the cost of debt? My default spread will go up. And if I wanted to estimate it, I'm going to compute an interest coverage ratio. I have three times more debt. Guess what? My interest expenses are going to be much higher. My interest expenses are much higher. My coverage ratio is going to be much lower. My rating is going to drop. My cost of debt is going to go up. Will my cost of capital be lower at 30%? I don't know. Until I worked out the numbers, I have no idea. The assumption that just because you increase the debt ratio, your cost of capital will go down is not true. It might not, depending on how the cost of equity and the cost of debt. So let's say in this case, the cost of capital does drop. Let's say it drops to 6.6%. That's good, right? Better than 6.8%. You're valuing Hormel Foods. Should you use the 6.8% cost of capital you got at the existing debt ratio, or should you use the 6.6% that you get with your target debt ratio? Jessica, you want help? Should you use the actual debt ratio or the target debt ratio? First, which will give you the higher value? Going with the target debt ratio, lower cost of capital, higher value, right? So this is good. But as an investor in the stock, why is it dangerous to use the target debt ratio? You're assuming it's your company. It's not your company. You don't run the company. And this is one of the problems I see with analysts using target debt ratios. People use it casually. I'll just replace the debt ratio with the target debt ratio for Apple. Really? You're Bob Iger? No, forget Bob. What am I saying? You're Tim Cook? Bob Iger doesn't run and happen. Because if it's not your company, you can't go around changing debt ratios. You know when you can change the actual to the, what kind of valuation can you actually change the actual debt ratio to the target debt ratio? Or when you're acquiring a company. When you're acquiring a company, this is your choice to make. If you're an investor in a company, I don't care what you and I think about the optimal debt ratio. We can't just casually move the debt ratio from where it is to the optimal without some serious danger to our investments. So if you're looking at a company and you have an actual debt ratio, start with the actual debt ratio. Don't just casually replace with the optimal because it's, in a sense, not your company to change things that you don't like. Now let's get to that terminal value. We've answered this question already in class. I want to make sure we got the right answer now. There are three ways to estimate terminal value. One of them should never be used in valuation, and I want you to tell me which one of these three approaches should never be used if you're doing a terminal value for an intrinsic valuation. The first is you can assume a perpetuity, growing perpetuity, put it all into a terminal value, R minus G, cash flow in year 11, so that's the first approach. The second is you can assume a liquidation value, where at the end of year 10 you stop, you sell off the assets, you get whatever you can get as cash flows, you treat that. The third is to apply a multiple of EBITDA or EBIT or net income or book value in year 10 to come up with the terminal value. This is the easy one. Which one of those three approaches should never be used if you're doing a discounted cash flow valuation? And why? Be ready to defend that because this is exactly what you will be. Because 9 out of 10 in investment banking valuations use 6 times EBITDA, 8 times EBITDA, 10 times EBITDA. I want you to be ready to explain to somebody the difference between a pricing and a valuation. Ready? You can try it out on me. What's the difference between a pricing and a valuation? Fernando, you want to try? What's the difference? A valuation, the company's value comes from its cash flows, its growth and risk. A pricing You're trying to attach a number to a company based on how similar companies are being priced out there. You say, what cares? When, shouldn't the two numbers be the same? Should the two numbers be the same? Not necessarily, right? Because when you're doing pricing, you've got to reflect the market mood. If market, the market loves social media companies and you're pricing a social media company, you're going to come up with a high price no matter what you think about the intrinsic value. Luis is valuing Tesla. Pricing Tesla and valuing Tesla are two different things. If you ask me to price Tesla, I'm looking at market mood. I'm looking at no trading volume. I'm looking at, because that's what pricing is. There's nothing unscientific or bad about it. It's just a different way of attaching a number to a company. So don't bring a pricing into a DCF. Yep, Sam.
Well, I know you said into a DCF, but what if you were acquiring a company and you wanted to divest the company through a pricing?
Then you're doing a pricing game. So don't even look at cash flows. Then do a pricing. Let's not even call it a DCF. Who cares about the cash flows? What do you even care about cash flows and disc? I'm saying, why are you wasting your time doing cost of capital? So let's say you have a 3-year window, right? You're going to buy now, you're going to sell 3 years from now. So what determines whether you make money or not? Whether the price goes up between now and 3 years from now, right?
Well, what if you also have cash flows?
Well, if the cash flows are needed to service debt, but you don't need a discount rate. The only reason you care about cash flows is why? Is to make sure that they're covering whatever needs you have over those 3 years. It's a very different reason for estimating cash flows, right? So if you're estimating cash flows because you have debt to pay off, you'll estimate the cash flows, but you're not going to have a cost of capital, no present value needed. All you need are the cash flows of the 3 years to make sure you're not going to get in trouble those 3 years. At the end of the 3 years, you're going to sell at a price, and as long as that end price is higher than the starting price, who cares? Not a DCF, right? It's not a valuation, it's a pricing.
So all LBO models?
All LBO models are pricing models. The LBO people won't like it when you tell them that. They're all pricing models, and I'm willing to make that argument to the 10 biggest LBO team. If they all came in here, I'm willing to make that argument. They're pricing players, and the sooner they accept that, the more honest they can be about this process. There's nothing intrinsic or DCF about what they're doing. Here's the only problem. When you're playing the pricing game and it fails, what are you left with? The company, right? And if you've not looked at the cash flows and done an intrinsic valuation of the company, you're going to be in big trouble.
Isn't the first part of the LBO model, you have 10 years of cash flows set the exact same way as a DCF without discount rate?
No, LBO model, the cash flows you're looking at are cash flows to service debt, right? The only reason you're looking at cash flows for the next 10 years is you're collecting the cash flows, you're using it to bring down the debt payments. You're not doing it for the same reasons I do DCF cash flows, where I'm using it as a way of saying, what's the value of the business? That's what I meant about. You're going to look at the cash flows, but it's for a very different reasoning, which is you've got to service all that debt you took in the LBO. It's the same way a bank estimates cash flows from a business to make sure you have enough to cover loan payments. So I'm saying you have to estimate cash flows to make sure you can service debt. But those cash flows, as long as they service the debt, you're not asking the question on an intrinsic basis, is this a good company to invest in? I can see you're not convinced, but think about it for a while. And, we'll come back to it later if you want. Okay? So let's now talk about doing a terminal value. Let's assume you have a company. The numbers you can do in your head, so don't bring out your calculators. So you get to a point, the company has $120 million after-tax earnings next year. Those earnings are cash flows as well because there's no growth in this company. It has a 10% cost of equity, and it's all equity funded. So $120 million after-tax operating income, not growing, 10% cost of equity, all equity funded. What's the terminal value for this company? $1.2 billion, right? 120 divided by 0.10, there's no growth. Now, what if I put a 2% growth rate into this company? What's the value of this company now? Seems like a no-brainer, right? 120 divided by 0.1 minus 0.02 is 1.5 billion. This is so magical. If I make that 4%, it'll become 2 billion. If I make it 6%, it'll become 3 billion. Something has to be off, right? If I put a 2% growth rate, what do I need to do to my numerator? My numerator was 120 million when I had zero growth because I assumed you could take all of your earnings and pay it out. So when I put a 2% growth rate, Barbara, what do I need to do? I have to factor in how much I need to reinvest to get the 2% growth rate. How do I come up with that reinvestment rate? I have a 2% growth rate. I need only one other item to get to the reinvestment rate. I need to know what your return on capital is. What if I told you return on capital is 10%? How much do you need to reinvest? 20%. What's 20% of 120 million? 24 million. So you take 24 million out of the numerator, you have 96 million. 96 million divided by 0.10 minus 0.02. I know this is a lot of stuff in your head. 96 divided by 0.08 is? 1.2 billion. I get the same terminal value if I put a 2% growth rate. But think of why. What is it about what I've assumed leaves my terminal value unchanged as I go from 0% growth to 2% growth? That the return on capital is equal to the cost of capital. So the next time somebody tells you, well, in my terminal value, if I just change the growth rate, the terminal value goes up. Stop that. That is not true. It goes up only because you casually leave the cash flows at what they were. But if you adjust the cash flows for your growth, whether your terminal value will go up or not will depend on what kind of return on capital you're assuming for this company in perpetuity. That's the big assumption in your terminal value, not just the growth assumption. So now I want somebody to keep a running tab in this example. Let's suppose you have a company which has a value that you got by discounting cash flows at the cost of capital of $100 million. So you took free cash flow to the firm, discounted the cost of capital, you came up with $100 million. So I'm going to go through line items, and with each line item, here's what I want you to tell me. Should I ignore it? Should I add it on? Or should I subtract? There are the only three choices. So I have $100 million obtained by discounting free cash flow to the firm at the cost of capital. This company has a $15 million cash balance. Add, subtract, or ignore. I don't want to make this as just a guessing game. What's going to determine whether you add, subtract, or ignore? What's the question you should ask? Have I counted it in already, right? If I'm discounting free cash for the firm at the cost of capital, have I counted the cash balance yet? What do you think? Try again. That's the right answer. And here's why. What did I discount? Free cash flow to the firm. What does free cash flow to the firm start with? Operating income. Where does interest income from cash show up? And then it shows up below the operating income line. I haven't valued... This is not a small... If I'm valuing Apple, what am I asking you? Should I add the $250 billion? If you say yes or no, that makes a huge difference, right? So I need to add the $15 billion. The reason is... because I haven't valued. So you get the structure of what you need to do. So 100, I'm going to add the 15 million. Let's keep going. Let's suppose this company has debt outstanding of 20 million. Add, subtract, or ignore to get to value of equity. Subtract, because equity investors get... So I'm going to subtract our 20 million. Now comes the part. Let's see if you're cross-holding. And you're finally, after two quizzes, ready for it. Let's suppose you have a 5% holding in another company. The book value of the holding is 5 million, but the market value of equity in that company is 200 million. Add, subtract, or ignore. Somebody said add. Who said add? Why add? But give me the reasoning, the same way we did for cash. Why am I adding it? Because the income from minority holdings is not part of my operating income. I want you to start thinking in those terms, because that'll tell you when to add things, when to ignore them, and when to subtract them. I should be adding the value of the minority holdings, but what's the number I should be adding? The book value or 5% of the 200 million, which is the market value? I should be adding 5% of the 200 million, which is market value, because I'm trying to come up with the value that I'm willing to pay for this company. Let's close the cycle. Let's suppose I have a minority interest of 10 million. Subtract, why? You're right. Why? Because when I did my operating income, what did I have in there? I had 100%, I had consolidation, right? And since I own less than 100%, I should be subtracting. So let me review. You start with 100 million, you added the cash, why you haven't counted it yet? You subtracted debt because it doesn't belong to you as an equity investor. Then you added the minority holdings because as minority holding, And then you subtract out the minority interest because that's the portion of the company that doesn't belong to it. You count it almost accidentally. Take this example and work it through because it's going to give you some perspective on what to add, what to subtract, and go through that reasoning. What's already in my cash flows? Because if it's already in your cash flows, don't add it. That's double counting. If it's not in your cash flows, then you got your work cut out for you. You got to figure out whether to add, subtract, or ignore. And that's basically those loose ends you have to do to get from value of the firm to value of equity. Let me do one final loose end here. What if I told you there was a lawsuit against this company? And that if you lose this lawsuit, it'll cost you $100 million. What would you need to ask as your final question to determine what the effect is? What is the problem? If I say there's a 100% chance, your equity just went to nothing, right? If I say there's a 10% chance, and you're saying, why am I doing this? Because it's not in your valuation already. And that's really why you constantly have to think about what have I already incorporated in value and what's left out. Let's get from equity value to equity value per share. Let's assume you have a company valued the equity at $200 million. You've done all the dirty work. There are 10 million shares outstanding. What's the value per share? Don't think too long. 200 divided by 10 is $20 per share, right? Now, let's suppose I forgot to mention that there are 2 million options outstanding in this company, employee options, but that the strike price is $20 per share. You see why I picked a strike price of 20? So I basically said these are at-the-money options. Will it change your assessment of value per share in this company to know that there are options outstanding that are at the money? Anna, why would it change your value? If I did that, I'd end up with 20. Because if I do the treasury stock approach where I count the proceeds and divide by the number of shares, because it's at the money, I'll actually end up with $20 per share. But is an at the money option worth nothing? You have the option, right? It's an at-the-money option, but it is still less value. And so what should we be doing? Taking the $200 million equity, subtracting out the value of the 2 million options, which even though they're at-the-money now, because they have life left in them, will be worth more than zero, and then dividing by the 10 million shares. And guess what? My value per share will be lower after I've learned this because you've created a second equity stake in the company in the form of options. You remember this page? This is the Wasserstein-Perella page, the forecasted cash flows. It was a pre-start of the class test, I think, session 3. And the cash flows they estimated were cash flows to equity on Carborundum, the target firm. And I gave you 4 different discount rates. I actually gave you a cost of capital for the acquiring firm, the cost of equity for the acquiring firm, the cost of capital for the acquiring firm, the cost of equity for the cost of capital of the target firm. So basically, acquiring firm cost of capital, target firm's cost of equity. If my cash flows are cash flows to equity for the target company, which of those 4 discount rates should I use? And remember, this is the hardest layer of hell. If you fail this, I'm sending you there. So if your cash flows are cash flows to equity in the target firm, the discount rate I should use is cost of equity or cost of capital? By now, it should be natural. Whenever you have cash flows to equity, your discount rate will always be cost of equity. And whose cost of equity should I use? The acquiring firm's cost of equity or the target firm's cost of equity? Ari? And give me the reasoning. What's the basis for that?
The risk is reflected
by the target risk. It's a cash flow risk that drives the discount rate. So if the target were a guaranteed cash flow, I'd use the risk-free rate as my discount rate. So that's a review of pretty much everything we did in intrinsic valuation. So let me show you what you found. So one of the first questions I asked you is, hey, what model are you using? It's a slam dunk. 90% of you are using free cash flow as the firm to value a company. About 5% use free cash flow to equity. And about 5% use the dividend discount model. So I'll guess that about 5% of you are valuing banks, because the dividend discount model often is the fallback that people have when they're valuing banks, especially if they don't want to confront regulatory capital. I kind of understand why firm valuation is always the most flexible way to start thinking about valuation, because you can change your mind later. You're going to free cash flow to equity, and we were talking, that's what I was mentioning to Sam. If things like leverage change, free cash plus equity can be much more messy to calculate. A lot of you valued the same company. So here were the most commonly valued companies. 4 of you valued Twitter. 5 of you valued Square. 7 of you valued Under Armour. 9 of you valued Yelp. And 9 of you valued Tesla. I remember in week 3, somebody coming up to me really upset saying, I picked a company to value. I've learned that somebody else in this class is also valuing the same company. Do I have to change companies? And I said, don't worry about it. It's all going to be okay. This is the same company. You know why I said don't worry about it? Here's the 9 Yelps you sent back to me. There isn't a single number. Not even the price for my... See, look at it. Which at least on that there should be some convergence. But depending on whether you did it early in the day on Friday, end of the day Friday, everything else, you get different numbers. You have 6 buys and 2 sells. The valuations range from $40 to $59.28. Why? Because in valuation, you get choices, right? You get to make choices. It's your story. I could have given every person this class Tesla to value, and I can guarantee you that if you just didn't steal somebody's spreadsheet and send it back to me, if you did your own valuation, there wouldn't have been a single convergence of the same valuation for the same company. That's why I make a big deal about stories, because if this were just about pumping numbers into a spreadsheet and spitting out valuations, we'd all be getting the same value. This is good that we're getting different values, because we'd all got the same value. It's horrible news. You know why? Because one step away from automation. Because I can just say, I don't need you. I just need a spreadsheet that reads numbers directly from Yahoo Finance into the spreadsheet. And I have a valuation. This is why we need human intervention. So work on this step, because this is what makes you useful, something that doesn't mean... It'll mean that you don't get outsourced at the drop of a hat. Think about what you bring to the process that goes from taking the numbers, spinning a story, and coming up with a value. So you want to see what your most undervalued stocks were? Remember, before I do that, let me show you what you found. Your median company was pretty close to fairly valued. But one point, so I took all your valuations, your DCF value compared to the price, and I looked at the difference. Your median company was about 1% off the price. So you got 50% of your companies came out as undervalued, 50% were overvalued. The average company was overvalued by 21%, because there are a couple of companies that you came up with massive overvaluations for the company. And I'll show you some of those companies. So across the class, you pretty much came at the conclusion that your DCF values were closer. That's not always been the case. This is a number I've tracked for 20-something years that I've been teaching the class. I'll show you what the numbers have looked like across time. But in this class, you were pretty much on, at least collectively, pretty close to the price. Here were your cheapest stocks. Again, remember, these are the numbers you send me, so don't blame me. Don't do anything stupid based on this list. Or if you do, do it on your own company, right? The most undervalued stock, according to you, is Petrobras. It's undervalued by 67.49%. Okay? You can look down the list, and I'll make a deal with you. If your company is on that list, you're telling me your stock is undervalued, all are buys. You know, why are you even listing it? Of course, they're going to be buys. You're going to see that that's not always the case, right? Here's what I want you to do. I will buy one of these stocks on this list. But you know which one I'm going to buy? I want you to buy first, and then I buy. So don't tell me you'd like to buy, but you have no cash. Then I'm not interested. I want you to send me a receipt from your brokerage house saying, I bought Petrobras or Thomas Cook, and I bought 1,000 shares, and I'll match you. Every semester that I've taught this class, I bought one stock off this list, because most of you hedge like weasels. You say, I value it, but I don't have the money. I value it, but sometime later. I value it, but one of these days. No. I actually need to see you buying, and because then you're telling me you actually buy into your own valuation. So it's open list. I don't know whose name goes with whom, but just send me that email with the proof, and I'll buy. Here are your most overvalued stocks. Whoever valued Twitter absolutely hated the stock. The story you were telling me was, I can't get to zero, right? So basically, your DCF value is $1.87. It's overvalued by like 900%. I'll make a deal with you. If you short the stock, I will sell my Twitter shares. I actually have shares in my portfolio, so I hope this is not true. Come on, Schlumberger, what is this hold? This is a weaselly little decision to make. Either buy or sell. Don't weasel out and say, hold the stock. Okay? But these were your most overvalued stocks. Okay? So those are your DCFs. Now, one of the reasons I keep track of this is, clearly, I think that this works. So I keep track over time of how your valuations have worked in terms of delivering returns. So this is just on the class. So basically, I give about 5 years between the time of your recommendations and tracking you, because otherwise it's too short a time period, it's not enough time. So these are the returns I get 5 years later. So the spring 1995 class, 5 years later, my buys were the blue, the red was the S&P 500, and the sells were the green. So the good news is across these periods, every single class, the buys have outperformed the index and the sells. That's the good news. Here's the kind of I won't even say it's bad news, but if you look at why, it's not because 100% of the buys go up and 100% of the sells go down. It's that 55% to 60% of the buys go up, 45% of the sells go down. So that's why you will need portfolios, no matter how confident you feel. Every single stock is not a slam dunk. Much of that excess return I make from your portfolios that I create comes from one or two stocks, big winners. It's a very skewed distribution. Right? So if I hadn't bought Apple in 99, which was one of the cheap stocks in 99, I wouldn't have made any excess returns over the next 5 years because it was the source of almost all of my excess returns from the buys. Question? No. And finally, if you've, at least over time, stocks that have emerged as both undervalued and underpriced, you know what I mean by that? I ask you to value the stock and price the stock, have done much better than stocks that are just undervalued or just underpriced. I told you I do valuation. That's where I go first. But I still look at the pricing because I'd like that helping me along because I want something undervalued and underpriced even though my faith might be in valuation. Let's talk about very quickly about multiples. Four-step test, right? Define, describe, analyze, apply. Just because Anna Kournikova knows what the P/E ratio is doesn't mean that her P/E ratio and your P/E ratio match up. So make sure it's consistently defined and uniformly estimated. Second, remember those histograms we draw that tell us what's high, what's low, what's average? Use the data. Don't throw it out. Play some money ball. Third, embedded in every multiple are all of the assumptions you're trying to run away from. There's DCF models, right? Growth, cash flows, and risk are in there. And finally, when you talk about applying the multiple, think about controlling for differences. I pushed a lot of regressions and statistics on you. You might not like them, push them away, but you have to figure out your own ways of controlling for differences. Okay? And that's part of the reason at the end of the multiple section, I kind of drew back to the fundamentals. With every multiple, I said there's a defining a driver variable, a variable you need to know that determines a multiple. You need to know what drives a multiple to be able to ask the right questions. So when I tell you something is cheap on a price-to-book basis, I want you to ask me, what's the growth rate? What's the return on equity? Think about that perfect undervalued stock, right? Low PE, high growth, low risk, high return on equity. That is your end game. And when we do screening, that's what we're aspiring to do. So here's what you did. A lot of enterprise value multiples. About 60% of you used enterprise value multiples, either EV to sales or EV to EBITDA. You know what that tells me? There's a lot of desperation in this room. Because you're climbing the income statement. Oh, that's not positive. That's not positive. That's not, oh, finally I got a positive number. Okay. The revenue number. And because many of you picked young companies, that's what you'd expect. And with your pricing, here's what you found relative to your DCF. So I wanted to see whether your pricing numbers were higher than your DCF. Your DCF value for the median company was actually slightly higher than your pricing. That actually is surprising because the conventional wisdom is DCF is conservative, pricing is not. That's not true. At least in this class, your DCF values are actually higher than your pricing for most companies. And the cheaper stocks on a pricing basis, and this is again your list, are these. Okay? Vince, I have no idea. Is that a person? I hope it's not a person that you bought, right? Tesla, 1622. Elon Musk will be really happy to have a meeting with you. But notice that there are a few buys in here. You're saying, why? Because the intrinsic valuation gave you a different answer and you've overridden the pricing. Remember what I said, you don't have to use your pricing in your recommendation. You just have to do the pricing and then tell me, I don't trust any of these pricings, so I'm going to go back to a DCF valuation. So these are your most undervalued. Your most overvalued, where's the Twitter guy again? As I said, you were slamming the stock. Not only did you lie, didn't like it on a DCF basis, it got even worse on a pricing basis. It's gone from $1.75 to $1.03. It's become overvalued by 1,708%. I'm going to read your report really carefully because this might make a difference in whether I hold on to your stock or not. That's not a threat. Don't worry. It's really I'm really interested to see what's going on. Right? So these are your most overvalued stocks. For about 1 in 5 companies, I asked you to use an option pricing model, right? Maybe 1 in 10. I think out of the 244 companies for which I got back summaries, there were about 12 companies, which means really 1 in 20 where you were. Because what did you need to do use an option pricing model? You needed a money-losing company with a lot of debt. So a lot of you said, look, it doesn't work for me, and that's fine. For the 12 companies where you could use an option pricing model, you were able to increase the value of the company by about 117%. That's the optionality. Does that mean that you're going to go buy the stock? Not necessarily. The optionality basically means you're so far underwater that risk is now your ally. Think of why, the intuition. When you're so far underwater, what's the worst that can happen to you? You can lose the rest of your money. You think that's bad enough? But that might not be very much because you're so highly levered. So if risk now becomes your ally, the optionality captures that value. Now, all of your valuations were status quo valuations. And value enhancement, you ask the question, what can I change to increase the value of the company, increase cash flows, increase... And that's what we did in the last session, right? And one of the things I did not get to in the last session that I just want to mention is every consulting firm has created some kind of proprietary value measure. It's a firm called Stern Stewart created something called EVA, Economic Value Added. Sounds fancy, but here's what they did. They took the difference between return on capital and cost of capital. Is that something we use already in DCF? Yeah, all the time. They multiplied by capital invested. Incredible, incredible insight there. And they came up with the dollar value. And they said, if that number is positive, that's good. And CEO said, really? Here's $500,000 for that incredible advice. Holt Associates used something called CFROI. Basically, it's an internal rate of return and said, if that's higher than your cost of capital, that's good. You say, why do consulting firms keep inventing these acronyms? Because that's how they make money. They've got to act like they've reinvented the wheel. And every one of them will claim that their approach is the best one, that it'll give you a better value. That's nonsense. In fact, if you look through your notes, I have a valuation of a company. I'm not going to cover EVA because it's clearly not even worth covering. But it's actually an example where I value a company using EVA, economic value added. And then I revalue the company using traditional DCF. And guess what I get as my value? My value for the company is exactly the same, whether I use EVA or discounted cash flow model. There's nothing new or different about these excess return models, the acronym, so don't let people tell you that this is somehow going to give you a better answer. So I'm almost to the end, so I want to kind of wrap up with some parting advice here. I took your recommendations, buy, sell, or hold, and I compared it to what previous semesters have taught me. So three numbers I want you to focus on. See the buy, the sell, and the hold. Spring of 2017, at the left-hand extreme, you had 105 buys, 105 sells, so it's almost 1-to-1, and 34 chickens, or holds, as you prefer to call them. So basically, you can see how that statistic, the highest buy I ever had was in spring of 2009. The ratio was almost 1.5. That was right after the crash. People found a lot of undervalued stocks. Right? And the lowest I had was actually spring of 2015. The number is about 45%. Is there any predictive power? I'm not going to read too much into it, but I do watch this number because it gives me a sense of collective wisdom about where the market is right now. So it's been a long class, right? So I'm going to leave you with some final thoughts on this. Right? If you're a storyteller, I hope this class gave you enough number crunching skills that you've developed some discipline. So the next story you tell, I want you to start thinking about numbers that go with that story. And if you're a number cruncher, and many of you are number crunchers, I hope you feel a little easier about telling a story, because without a story, a valuation has no soul. It's just a collection of numbers. I don't like to give too much advice. I'm actually supposed to give a closing session to the second-year MBAs today at 5 o'clock in the graduating MBA class, and they want advice. I have none. So I'm going to give you whatever little advice I have. First is, it's all in the fundamentals. Every generation thinks it rediscovers the truth, but the basis for value has stayed the same for as long as people have been doing valuation. It's cash flows, growth, and risk. Nothing changes. Second, it's very easy to lose sight of the big picture here, because as you get lost in the details of computing cash flows and discount rates, sometimes you need to step back and say, is this worth the time I'm spending on it? So if you're worried about the pre-tax cost of debt you're using to come up with the least present value, ask yourself, is it even worth the trouble in this company? Third, a lot of anecdotal evidence out there. Right? I'm going to draw on my mother-in-law twice today. First, my mother-in-law comes up with these incredible rules, and you have no idea where they come from. Now, I remember about a decade ago, I was sitting at dinner, and she says, the best car to drive in a snowstorm is a Volkswagen Bug. Have I told you the story before? Eh? That's the anecdotal evidence. That's exactly what you get with a lot of analysts, anecdotal evidence. And here are the final two things, and these are the final two things I end all of my classes with. First, it's going to sound very strange. Don't take any of this stuff too seriously. Just tell yourself, it's only money. If your reaction is, what else is there? I suggest you get some spiritual counseling. Talk to your priest, your rabbi. I can't help you, right? It's only money. I remember about 6 or 7 years ago, end of a second year MBA class, and a graduating MBA comes up to me. She was a history major from Yale who came back for an MBA. If you're a history major from Yale, usually take the strategic MBA route, which is you pick classes with the word strategic in it, and you can go through 2 years without ever seeing a number. You take strategic management, strategic accounting. I've always wanted to sit in on that class. How do you do accounting without numbers? I guess you use those Harvard case studies which talk about fuzzy stuff. But she ended up in my valuation class, which, as you've seen, is not a strategic valuation class. She turned out to be pretty good at it. At the end of the class, she comes up to me and she says, I never thought this would happen, but I have a job as a sell-side equity research analyst. I said, my condolences. No, I said, congratulations. And she said, I'm really scared. I said, what are you so scared about? She said, what if I make a mistake? I said, be glad you're not a brain surgeon. You make a mistake, somebody dies on the table. You make a mistake, what's the worst that's going to happen? Somebody gets a little richer. Somebody else gets a little poorer, right? Think like a Marxist. You move some wealth around. The world hasn't ended. Let it go. Final piece of advice. If you're ever given a choice between knowing everything there is to know about valuation and being lucky, which one should you pick? Don't even think for a second. Pick being lucky. I hate to let you in on this, especially after you spend an insanely large amount of money on an undergraduate degree. This is a business where luck is the dominant paradigm. What does that mean? It's what separates success from failure. It's not skill. It's not what you know. If you're lucky, you can do some really sloppy stuff and get away with it. If you're not lucky, you're screwed. You can do everything right. Nothing's going to work for you. Brought home to me again by my mother-in-law when she came to visit early in 2000. Now, during the 1990s, my mother-in-law became an avid investor, which to me should have been a sign that the market was topping off. Mother-in-law, big investor, get out of the market now. I kind of missed that sign. She came to visit, and all day long, she would watch CNBC. It was like a spectator sport. No? Every time one of our stocks would go on the ticker, go Cisco, go, convince us, it was actually, look, it went up an eighth. She was convinced she was the competitive advantage that drove Cisco to great heights in the 1990s. And all day long, all she would talk about what was in her portfolio, what was out of her portfolio, what she wished was in, what she wished was out. And I had to act like I was listening. That's what son-in-laws do. And then she lets it slip that she owned Qualcomm, one of the great stocks of 99, up 600%. I was impressed. So I asked her, Judy, how do you pick Qualcomm? I knew the minute I asked this question, I shouldn't have, because she told me. She said she picked Qualcomm because it owned MCI. I said, that's not Qualcomm, that's WorldCom. She says, Qualcomm, WorldCom, what's the difference? I said, you bought the wrong company. If you really meant to buy the company that owns MCI, you'd have lost 30%. So you buy some other company that rhymes with it and makes 600%? I was afraid to ask her after that why she owns Cisco, afraid the answer might be, I like Saturday Night Live. But after she left, I did try a strategy. I'd pick a stock in the news, pick one that rhymes with it. You know what? If I'd made a lot of money, forget about this intrinsic value stuff. I'd have adopted the rhyming stock strategy. It didn't work for me. But if I have a wish for you, be lucky. And if I know I will not get to talk to you until, you know, at the end of the final day, time to turn in your exams, so that's not really talking. So if you get stuck and you need to ask a question, you have my email address, right? I have no idea where I'm getting emails from, so I do the same thing of answering pretty much every email I get. So if you get stuck and you need some help, no, you have my email address, and I wish you the very best. No? Thank you very much for sitting in.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Take care.
Thank you. Really enjoyed the class.